Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. In this episode, we're taking a look back at some of the highlights from previous episodes. Since launching in 2019, we've made more than 400 episodes. We've explored some absolutely fascinating topics and met hundreds of wonderful people. And those people all have one thing in common, a deep knowledge of and a passion for the food and drink industry. Today, we're taking a look back at some of the best conversations we've had about the history of food. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Now, I have in my hand here, I don't know if you can hear it there, but a small handful of yellowish, sort of light brown yellowish, I mean, they clearly look like peas or beans, look like beans. I'm going to just crush them in my hand like that to give them a little bit of a starter. And when you crush them, the little crispy sort of seed coatings come off, and underneath is a light green bean. Now, if I bite that light green bean, well, first of all, I might lose a tooth because it's really, really hard. But also, there's absolutely nothing to it. There's no flavour whatsoever. So you kind of think, why would you ever bother to do anything with this? Well, what we're going to do is, I've got a little blowtorch here. So here's my blowtorch. Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to roast a bean. Now, it just sort of burns it a little bit, chars it around the outside, and as it begins to heat up, it browns. It's expanding a little bit, and it's looking a little bit oily on the outside. And it's got a little sheen to it. But also, already here in my little studio, there's this extraordinary smell. Okay, I think that'll probably do the trick, just a tiny little bit. So I've just sort of browned it a little bit. It's got a beautiful glisten to it. Now let's have a little look at it. I'm going to have a smell of this bean. Okay, so already there is the most extraordinary set of complex flavours that are, to me, are quite magical. And they're sort of musky, they're spicy, sort of chocolatey. I mean, all sorts of different things going on. So it's pretty obvious that what I've got here is a coffee bean. Now, once a coffee bean has been roasted, you get coffee. It's a heady blend of flavour chemistry and psychoactive mind-altering drugs. But it's also packed with culture and history and cash. It's a $460 billion market. There's even been an espresso machine used on the International Space Station. Now, to discuss one of the most interesting food and drink stories of them all, I'm joined by Professor Jonathan Morris. Jonathan is Vice President of the Royal Historical Society, Professor of Modern History at the University of Hertfordshire, and he's the author of Coffee, A Global History. He also co-hosts the History of Coffee podcast series. Jonathan, it's a real pleasure to have you.
Great to be here, Stefan. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Okay, can you paint the picture of the journey of the bean itself? So coffee beans are seeds in a cherry growing on a bush. Can you explain a little bit more about it? Paint the picture of the stuff itself for us.
We know something of its origins, and some of it we have to sort of deduce. Okay, so within the context of being in Ethiopia, of being in that area of the Horn of Africa, it was foraged primarily. It was foraged as a wild product. And when I say it, I'm thinking here about all elements of the plant. So they were using the leaves for producing a kind of tea. They would use the fruits to produce both foodstuffs. There's a sort of a kind of an energy bar that you can create using the sort of the cherries, so the dried cherries, but also that they would kind of start brewing things with the husks of those dried fruits. So once the things are really dried out. Now, it's that beverage that appears to start the kind of the road to coffee, in the sense that this is, as far as we can tell, begins to be imported, these dried fruits, into Arabia from about the 1450s. And at this point, they're being used to prepare a beverage there, which is commonly known as kisha, which essentially is sort of adding sort of hot water to these sort of dried, desiccated fruit. And it produces a much more, it's kind of a tea-like beverage. In fact, if you've ever experienced what's now called cascara, which is kind of coffee cherry, dry coffee cherry that can be used as teas, it's that kind of a beverage.
So this is without them being roasted?
At this stage, it's without them being roasted.
As you've said that, I have here a cup of unroasted coffee bean tea. Coffee tea, I suppose it would be.
Okay.
That I made earlier. I haven't tasted it yet, so I'll have a go right now. So this is basically, it's kind of a slurry where I've just ground up a lot of the green beans, the unroasted beans. So let's have a little taste. Yeah, it's a tea, I guess. It's a tisane. It's got some aromas to it. It's slightly musky, but slightly flowery as well, I guess. I would enjoy that, I guess, if I'd chosen it, but seeing as I could have made that into a coffee, I'm not so keen.
I'm just trying to check whether you've actually used the skins of the fruit in that as well, Stefan, because that's...
So I've got the coffee, the beans with the husks on. But not the whole cherry.
Okay, yeah, but not the whole cherry.
Ah, that's what I've missed out.
So that's the difference. Yeah,
gotcha.
I mean, you are getting something that probably tastes like something that they might have well prepared in Ethiopia itself. But I think you're probably closer to a tea than what would be the case with kisha, where you'd have that fruit coming through.
Mm-hmm. And have you tasted coffee leaf tea?
I have tasted something like coffee leaf tea. I've also tasted cascara quite frequently, which is the sort of, you know, with the dry cherry itself. The dry cherry drink is very interesting. So although it is made of dry cherry, it supposedly would have less caffeine than using just the concentrate of the bean. Mm-hmm. But I find it quite buzzy. It certainly has an effect on you. And that's, of course, what was attractive about it.
And Ethiopia has a lot of these substances. I mean, when I was in Ethiopia, we ate cat, not the four-legged animal, but K-H-A-T.
Oh, yes.
And again, the buzz was quite important. I actually had a strange allergic reaction to it at the time, but that's immaterial. That's not the point. So back to the journey of coffee. How does it move from Ethiopia? Do we know much about its journey from its origins?
The interesting thing, Stefan, there is, consciously or not, you've actually made the intro for me to this story, in the sense that what we understand from an Arabic manuscript from around the 1550s is that a Sufi leader called Al-Dubani, Sufis were using at this point cat in their ceremonials, if you like. They used that to enable them to sort of get into a meditative state to perform their mantras. They used to chant mantras. And there appears to have been a shortage of cat. And so Al-Dubani told his followers, well, you know, we could try importing this thing that I tried in Ethiopia, this beverage, which they call kisha, which is made of the coffee cherry. So the coffee cherry begins to be imported into Yemen. It's adopted by the Sufis, and gradually it spreads through the Arabian Peninsula. It reaches Mecca, which obviously is a big site where many pilgrims would come from around the whole of the Islamic diaspora. And that way it becomes popular in its first sort of popularity, to the extent that by the 1550s in Yemen, we know that coffee starts being grown as a cultivated crop itself.
So do you think that the initial spread is the psychoactive nature of coffee more than the flavour?
Yes, undoubtedly. It's that psychoactive effect, it's that buzzy effect, and it's being used to produce that sort of induced combination of sort of slight headiness and psychoactivity that enables people to get into their dedication. So it's not really about flavour at that point, it's about function.
Yeah. And do we know much about the chemistry of earlier coffee beans? Would they have, because, I mean, we both had a coffee this morning. I wouldn't say I'm in a meditative state. I'm not hitting the mantras yet. Do you think that back in the day, it had a different effect, or maybe that people were more susceptible to the caffeine that was inside it?
I suspect they're more susceptible because, I mean, we are now a very heavily caffeinated society. We're encountering caffeine in all kinds of ways that we don't even calculate, as well as the ones that we are aware of. So I think that this is a bit like your first time ever to hit caffeine. And also you're not hitting a lot of caffeine regularly. So, I mean, one thing that we do know about caffeine is that our bodies adapt to it. just in the way that alcohol. So, I mean, I guess the simple parallel would be if you think about when you have your first drink after you've maybe abstained for a month or two, and you think about how that suddenly hits you as very heavy. And then within a few weeks of drinking, you're probably not finding one glass of wine or whatever at all sort of transformative.
Yeah.
And this is really about the way that your body reacts and adapts to that.
Today is all about food and love. Well, food and sex, really. Specifically, the idea of aphrodisiacs, foods which it's claimed have an erotic power. In modern times, oysters or chocolate are claimed to do the job, but further back, foie gras and caviar. Through history, stranger things still. On my travels making food documentaries in some of the world's more difficult places, I've been offered all sorts. Rhino horn, and I wasn't asking for these things, by the way. Rhino horn, gorilla paw, testicles and penises of various strange species. But none of these have ever had any aphrodisiacal effect. So here's the question. Do food aphrodisiacs actually work? And if so, is it about the food or the context? We're going to dig into the history of aphrodisiacs to find out a bit more. Well, with me are two absolutely fabulous guests. We have Ursula Janssen. She's an archaeologist, culinary historian, and author of several books, including historical novels and recipe books. Hello there, Ursula.
Hi.
Great to have you. We've also got Martha Hopkins from marketing and book publishing company Terrace Partners. In 1997, she co-wrote Intercourses, an aphrodisiac cookbook, which has sold, and just wait for it, 325,000 copies in the United States and Canada alone. Hello there, Martha.
Hello.
Riding high on that figure, I would imagine. Now, Ursula, over the course of history, has the idea, because there's a bit of sort of date rape drug sort of side to this as well, isn't there? It sounds a bit dodgy. In the course of history, has this idea of an aphrodisiac changed at all?
Yes, I would say yes, it did. I mean, in general, I would say it's an ingredient, a substance or a dish that is meant to enhance lust and passion. But in the past, often also fertility was an important point. And
right.
What is now called, or what we would now call an aphrodisiac, if we look back at those, they were often then in the explanation why they were considered an aphrodisiac. Also, fertility was an important argument. So that has definitely changed. I mean, historically, the word aphrodisiac comes from the Greek goddess of love, Aphrodite. And because she was said to carry a number of mysterious love potions at her belt, and these were the aphrodisiacs. So yes, you also have this love potion idea pretty much from the beginning.
And can we extrapolate this? I mean, can we separate the love bit from the sex bit, Ursula? I mean, don't get me wrong. I know they're closely interlinked, but what was more important?
Well, it depends very much. I mean, I would divide aphrodisiacs into seven different categories. And some of them are more focused on the, let's say, biological part, and some are more focused on lust, on passion. And I definitely think that the sensual part plays a big, 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 big role, because we know that many of those foods that have ever been considered an aphrodisiac, and if we look back into history, also on an international level, we see that basically there's nothing that has not claimed to be an aphrodisiac at some point in history.
The potato was once claimed to be an aphrodisiac, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Anything.
Yeah. Before we go on, could you you mentioned seven groups.
Yes.
Could you tell us what those seven are?
Yes, of course. I would start with shape analogy. So any food that visually reminds us of either female or male reproductive organs, that could be all kind of mussels and shellfish, that could be asparagus, anything that is long, carrots, celeriac things, even lettuce actually, not because the round lettuces we know now, but because if you see lettuces, if you let them grow, they shoot up and they have this white sap coming out from the top. So, I mean, they're very...
What? Where's the white sap coming out of your lettuce, Ursula?
If you let
Ursula
it grow...
Ursula is joining us from Puglia in Italy, where clearly lettuces are slightly different these days.
No, if you forget to harvest it and it overgrows.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. When it goes to seed.
Yes, exactly.
Which is, yes, very appropriate. Yeah, okay, so that's the shape.
Yeah, that's a shape. Then we have high-protein foods. I mean, in history, nutrition was not as given as it is now. So anything that is strengthening, basically. And for this, yeah, basically high protein foods, especially eggs, because there you also have the fertility aspect. So all kinds of eggs, bird eggs, fish eggs. There is sometimes it was like, for example, at the court of Louis the 15th in France, a mix of raw egg yolks and ginger was used, and they used to add alcohol. I mean, an eggnog in the end is nothing else. There is a medieval Arab treatise that describes the consumption of big, of huge quantities of eggs as the key to male potency, whereas this one only talks about male potency. That's another thing, actually, we should be discussing, because a lot of these treatises talk about, they have a pretty male point of view, let's put it like that.
Well, yes, it sounds like it. Okay, so we've got shape, we've got high protein. What's number three?
Number three, I would say, is humorism. The concept of humorism is the antique concept that was used until early modern times in medicine that divides basically anything, all kinds of foods, but also all kinds of body types into four categories, which is blood, back bile, yellow bile, and phlegm. And to these attributed are hot and wet, cold and wet, hot and dry, and cold and dry.
Yeah.
Which does not mean the actual temperature, but kind of foods are attributed to it. So everything like chili, garlic, everything that is spicy is hot, and pickled cucumbers are cold, for example.
Yeah, gotcha.
And this was very, very, very important as a concept in medicine and also for aphrodisiacs. Basically, everything that is hot was considered an aphrodisiac. Hence, for example, in the Middle Ages, in monasteries, hot foods were avoided and they rather got things like pickled vegetables, which were considered cold.
Yeah.
And this is why we have a lot of also antique recipes or proportions to eat lots of garlic and onions, which, of course, also has an adverse effect in terms of smell.
Speak for yourself.
But probably both have to eat it, then it's fine.
Yeah, that's fair enough. That's fair enough.
Okay, so that is humorism, yeah?
Okay, number four.
Number four is what I would say is exotic and thus expensive and rare foods. Luxury.
Now we're hitting the motherlode here, come on.
Yeah, I mean, luxury is, yeah, well, it's the central part in the end. It's the feeling of having a special day, evening, night, whatever. I think this is more important than many of the actual ingredients.
Yeah, yeah. And back to context again. Okay, so we've got exotic and luxury. Number five?
Yeah, number five is the idea, what you were talking before of the rhinoceros penises and stuff, is the idea of transferring powers from other creatures onto the consumer,
yeah.
Which is, there is no evidence whatsoever that it works. It has been done for a long time and it is not advisable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Simply,
yeah,
I think absolutely. We can... Pretty. I mean, another quite disgusting use was in early modern times was the mumia, you know, the powdered human Egyptian mummies that were sold as a general tonic, but also specifically as an aphrodisiac. And
yeah.
It actually comes from a translation mistake, because mumia in Arabic is a kind of bitumen-like substance that is used as a general tonic in the Middle East and was also used in ancient Greek. And this is why the mummies are called mummies, because that was also used for embalming those bodies, but lost in translation, they thought they meant actual mummies, which is a sobering reminder of the value of correct translations.
Yeah, absolutely. I find that grinding up my dead relatives really gets it going for me. Okay, and number six, we got a couple more to get through here.
Yes, so number six is, I think, the sensual side in general, apart from the exotic, which is a good smell, like in antiquity, especially at banquets, incense was burned to create a festive environment, or also to help cover bad body odors, which in times before regular showers or baths were available to everyone, was also important. And this is why, for example, in medieval treatises, mint is regarded as an aphrodisiac, simply to cover up bad breath.
When I was a teenager, I just, whenever I smelt, I just added more deodorant over the top. There was no point in going for a bath. Okay, so smell, taste, and the sight, I guess, and things like that. And number seven.
And number seven, I would say there are substances that have an actual effect on the body, which exists but is rare. There are some, well, few kitchen spices or herbs like saffron, nutmeg, but you also shouldn't overdo them. Parsley, but you need to eat huge, enormous quantities to get there, which I'm not sure whether...
You can hallucinate on nutmeg, can't you, as well? But, I mean, you got to eat a heck of a lot of it.
And probably the most potent, legal, food-related drug is alcohol.
Aphrodisiac,
yeah. But also in moderation, again, because too much is counterproductive.
Exactly. We're talking about hydraulics here at certain levels, aren't we? And so you've got to bear that in mind.
Today, we're looking at the complex, bittersweet history of sugar. Sugar is at least partly responsible for some of the worst health crises facing our country, but it's also the most happiness and pleasure-inducing food on the planet, which is why some people suggest that it's as addictive as cocaine. Sugar has the most extraordinary chemistry, performs a huge range of structural functions in foods that are really difficult to achieve with other ingredients. Then there's sugar's history, marked by suffering and exploitation. It's impossible to discuss the sugar industry and not discuss the slave trade. With me to dig into it is Neil Buttery. Neil is an evolutionary biologist, a food historian, chef, author, blogger, and a podcaster. And his book, A Dark History of Sugar, has just been published. Neil, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to have you here. Now, let's dig deep into the history. Now, there are great stories about Elizabeth I brushing her teeth with sugar. It doesn't sound like a good idea, was it? So can you tell us a little bit about the early history of sugar?
So sugar originated, if you like, as a crop in New Guinea around 8,000 BC, and it travelled through Asia into India. So sugar cane is a kind of grass. So if you've ever grown bamboo, which is a kind of grass in your garden, you'll know that they're pretty aggressive weeds, really. They send out little vegetative roots and they end up popping up all over. So people aren't sure whether it travelled along there or whether people took it, but it ended up in India. And it was there where it was first extracted, the juice was first extracted from the cane and boiled down to make the brown sort of lump sugar, I suppose you could say, called ghee, which is also called jaggery.
Jaggery, yes.
Whilst in India, it was then taken up by the Persians, although it took a good 1,000 years for anybody to take it seriously. But in the 7th, 8th century, you kind of get what we would think of as a sugar plantation. It's not as important as wheat, perhaps, to civilization. But when it's empire that we're talking about, that's when sugar really comes centre stage. The Islamic Empire grew, you know, around the Near East, North Africa, and a little bit into Spain, of course, and some of the Mediterranean islands. And wherever they went, they grew sugar with them. It wasn't being sold to anywhere else around the world. It was very much a self-contained thing, but it was fueling their empire. And it's strange, really, because there's no extant primary sources about how these sugar plantations developed. They just kind of appear fully formed. So no one really knows.
And so what is the next stage? So you have early plantations, and then what happens
next? Well, the First Crusade happens.
And what date are we talking about for the First Crusade?
Late 11th century. Oh, 1104, if I'm right, actually. So just squeaking into the 12th. There was a siege of Acre, and the crusading knights from all around Europe got caught in the siege, and they tasted sugar cane rather than sugar because they were basically starving. But they thought it delicious. They tried some sugar. They took some scraps of sugar home and passed it around court. And everyone thought, oh, yeah, that's great, whatever. Second Crusade, that's when it really kicks off. Really large amounts of samples were brought back. And that's when people begin to think, we should get into this. This is really good.
And what data are we talking for the Second Crusade?
Mid-12th century. And really over the next, I would say, 100 years, as the Crusades became more successful, they took over the Holy Land and Syria and a part of Egypt and kicked everyone out and took over these plantations. But to make sure things were ticking over, they kept the important people, sugar masters and planters and things like that, and they began to learn from them. And I guess this is when it started getting darker, really. I suppose up until now, it's all been kind of fine. As soon as the Europeans started making sugar, they thought, right, how can we make this cheaper and how can we make more of it? And how can we make this at any cost? We don't really care. And this is where capitalism essentially begins. Because the most basic concept of capitalism is profit at any cost.
Mm.
And they started to centralize the final purification process. So collecting from loads of plantations, taking it into the cities, because, you know, it was done in the countryside. It was a farm. Brought it into the cities and start boiling it down. And before you get it, it's got to be the earliest or one of the first instances where you've got inner city pollution caused by industry of man.
And industry on quite a big scale, I guess, as well, and quite destructive because you need so much fuel for it.
That's right. And then what happened next was Saladin's nephew ended up getting the Holy Land back off the crusading knights when with their tails between their legs. But at least they thought, at least we know how to make sugar now. And then they took sugar throughout the Mediterranean.
Do you mean the crop itself as a growing crop?
That's right. So it's become a real expensive commodity crop for the upper classes by now.
Yeah.
They're moving eastwards because they're gobbling up all the forests, clearing more space, and they go, oh, brilliant, there's more space now, so we can grow even more sugar. So they just naturally ended up going west, right to the edges of the old world, and they ended up on Madeira and the Canary Islands. And that really was the frontier. If the new world hadn't been discovered, probably the sugar industry would have probably just died out via deforestation.
By the sheer requirement for fuel, which is, you know, a massive problem. And then you get all sorts of problems, not just deforestation, but soil degradation and, you know, soil loss and habitat loss and a sort of sequence of events. So what happens next then?
They're kind of stuck. But then Christopher Columbus goes and discovers the New World, doesn't he? So first of all, they thought, oh, brilliant, a massive forest we can cut down for the sugar. Hooray. No one really knew how big it was.
Another forest, here we go.
But it's important to remember, actually, before I carry on Madeira and the Canary Islands, this is the first time African slaves had been used.
And how did that work? What was the process of that?
So we're talking in the 1420, a Portuguese sailor was exploring Africa to set up some colonies in Africa, because this is the beginning of, you know, the big phase of colonialism in Europe.
Land grab.
Yeah, not thinking about sugar, thinking about gold, spices, ivory. And it's called Gonçalves, was this Portuguese guy. He captured some men of African descent and Asian descent. And it turned out that they were both Muslims. And they argued with him, look, you can't take us away to be slaves. Because slavery was happening everywhere at this point. You know, I mean, I'm not saying it's okay, but every country pretty much had slaves. But usually they were slaves because they were at a frontier or they were prisoners of war.
Well, we know the Romans had slaves, you know. And
yeah, there were, yeah, Vikings had slaves, Britons had slaves. So yeah, everywhere had slaves. But this was different. He wasn't taking over Africa. These weren't prisoners of war. The argument was by these guys who had been captured was, no, but we're men of God. Okay, we don't agree. It's different religions, but we are essentially praying about the same God. It shouldn't be us that you take. But we know some people you might like. And they said, there's some people here, and they call them Sons of Ham. I'm not very good on my biblical studies. I don't know about you, Stefan, but Sons of Ham. Ham was a son of Noah, and through some strange, I don't know what, some strange series of events, Noah got really drunk and stripped naked. And Ham spotted him, and so ashamed, it seems, that Noah was of his son seeing him naked, that he banished his son.
Biblical times, fun times.
And also cursed him to a life of servitude. And not only that, he said that this applies to all of your descendants as well.
Mm.
So that's what these guys had said to Gonçalves, like, these are the sons of Ham. They're born slaves. You should just take them. So they did. At this stage, it's just supplementing the workforce. I mean, it's all awful. But as we're about to find out, it gets a lot worse, which is why I'm using the word just. So, you know, there's no real slave trade per se. And the, you know, society's made up of just slaves. Yeah, that was to come later. But that's the first time we get the connection with the African people and sugar making.
Today, we're looking at the history of curry. Now, we are obviously a nation of curry lovers, and curry is big business in the UK. And it's not just here in the UK. Whether you're sitting under palm trees in Abu Dhabi or on a night out in Glasgow, you're part of a global curry scene. And with this global spread, comes a fascinating history, bringing together centuries of trade, immigration, colonialisation, and culinary innovation. So with me to look into the history of curry are two fabulous guests. We have Shrabani Basu, who's a journalist, frequently to be seen and heard on radio and TV, talking about Indian history and empire. And she's also a fantastic and successful author. Her many works include the book Curry, the Story of the Nation's Favourite Dish. Hello there, Shrabani.
Hello.
Very good.
It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And we're also joined by another fantastic writer, food historian Lizzie Collingham, author of The Hungry Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World, and also Curry, A Tale of Cooks and Conquerors. Hello there, Lizzie.
Hello.
It's great to have you too. Right. Now, Shrabani, does the word curry annoy you? Is it one of those catch-alls that sort of rides over so much, you know, so much culture, history and flavour that it doesn't mean anything?
Well, it stopped annoying me now. I use the word. It's like, you know, all Indian films are called Bollywood films and, yeah. You know, that's not the way it is. So you just get used to these generalisations. But I do want to follow up on Lizzie's. You know, the Portuguese are so interesting because we associate Indian food with red chilies and, you know, chili powder and tomatoes. And of course, it was the Portuguese, wasn't it, Lizzie? I mean, they are the ones who got chili into India.
The heat
in Indian cooking before that came from pepper, which is what the Portuguese, you know, which is what everybody came there to look for in India, trade in pepper, basically. That was gold for them. But they brought in red chilies. So that changed Indian cuisine, tomatoes, all these things that we now accept as, you know, being a sort of base for Indian cooking came with the Portuguese. So curry is something that evolves. I mean, Indian cooking has evolved over centuries and it continues to do so, which is what makes it fascinating.
Exactly. Indian cuisine is one of those things. It absorbs all kinds of influences, pulls them in and spits them out in different forms. Just, I mean, that's how cuisines evolve, isn't it? Yes, the chili arrives within 30 years of the Portuguese arriving in South India. There are chilies growing wild and they work very well. They replace long pepper more than they do black pepper. Black pepper remains an important, but long pepper was annoying because it would go moldy if you tried to store it. I think it's kind of long catkin like thing. And so chilies really replace that very well. So, and I think it also has vitamin C and it grows easily. And so chilies then spread slowly up the peninsula. The Marathas take on chilies and then the Mughals say, oh, these horrible, fiery, chili-eating people coming. So the Mughals aren't eating chilies at that point. So they spread up and so on. And then when the British are settled and in cantonments and so on, around their European cantonments, the British cantonments, vegetable market gardens develop, which try to grow the vegetables that the British are missing. So, yes, those things, potatoes, cauliflower, peas, things that we think of now as quintessentially Indian, you would expect to find them in an Indian dishes and so on. Tomatoes are such a Punjabi, Bengali base. They're all brought in by Europeans.
So all the Columbian Exchange again, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. So I wonder, did the British get that to begin with? So we're talking very much about how the British, you know, we worship the curry now, you know, whatever that definition we have of it. Originally, why was that? Was it a chili hot food that they began with? Why did it sort of seep into our consciousness?
Initially, in the 17th century, when Thomas Rowe, the British English ambassador to the Mughal emperor, arrives in India, you know, he's coming from a society in England. It was quite common to use spices. Why were the English there? They'd gone because they wanted to get the spices, right, which they were importing in order to, they were trying to circumvent the Arab world and Venice. And they were eating a cuisine. The elite cuisine was influenced by Catalan cuisine, which was a meld between Spanish and Arab influences because the Arabs had been in charge of the Iberian Peninsula. And so that elite, very, very spicy cuisine was already very, very, they were accustomed to it. So when Terry, Ron of Rose sidekicks, arrives in, he describes a chicken dish, which is a bit like a korma. He says it's very much like blancmange, which was a chicken dish in Europe. So they love it because it's not particularly different or unusual. And then later on in the 18th century, when the East India Company is established and British and English when they settle there and work there as officials, they love the food that they're served by their Indian cooks, and they want to bring it back and they want to bring it home. It's as the British become more established in India, their cooks adapt the flavour range for the food that they're cooking for them. And so then British curries tend to be much more flavoured with coriander and ginger rather than cardamom and cloves. Those are the kind of, that's the flavour palette that the British really like. And so curries get adapted, or curries, so to speak, get adapted for British tastes while the British are in India.
Yeah. So, Shribani, can you give us some examples of some of the early curries that the British would have eaten?
So there's descriptions by all the travellers, and these are, you know, really interesting. So they go, I mean, we have Sir Thomas Rowe. I mean, he attends these banquets because he's there as the ambassador in the court of the Mughal Emperor Jahangir. And the descriptions are of like 50 course meals and elaborate meal settings. And the rice, which is in, you know, different coloured rices, just the rice itself is in various varieties. So they are absolutely seduced by these flavors. There's no going back, you know, once you've tasted these. So there is this hankering to adapt and also to bring it back, which is why the returning East India Company officials, then they're called the Nabobs, they hanker for this food when they come back home. And that starts this journey of bottling up this magic in a curry powder, you know, in a little jar, a bottle, and sending it back home. So then also housewives are creating these. So by sort of the 19th century, there is a craze for cooking curries for housewives to show off. So it just keeps evolving. They buy them at chemists, jars of these.
Yeah, yeah.
They're advertised in the papers, Bengal hot curry, Hobson's curry, curry powder, and they'll have this man, you know, typical sort of images, a snake charmer,
exactly.
Heat. And, you know, they are absolutely marketing the Orient. So it's there, and it's, you know, exotica in a bottle. They buy these and they recreate them. Often there are recipes along with these bottles and jars, and they are recreated in England.
When they first come back, they bring cooks with them quite often, or they bring recipes. And the earliest recipe for a curry that's published in 1847, but also the Duke of Portland, I think they have the earliest manuscript recipe for a curry. They are actually attempts to create an Indian dish with separate spices that you roast and then grind. That Eliza Acton says, roast your coriander on a shovel over the fire and so on. So they do attempt to properly reproduce proper recipes, but then they start to take shortcuts and you get Dr. Arnott's curry powder and so on in recipe books and so on. The Major General recommended to me, so-and-so recommended to me this. Yes, and he recommends this combination to make the best curry. And then they take shorthand and it becomes much more of a generic dish, which is just onions, then the curry powder, then the meat. And so that it evolves over time. It isn't a straightforward, it's a process by which
absolutely.
The British constantly take shortcuts to make this what we think of now as a curry.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.